Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our new website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans, and welcome to episode number 180 of the Peristyle Podcast. Today is August 1st, 2011, beginning of August, USC Fall Camp just around the corner. We got a lot to talk about this week on the podcast, talking about USC Fall Camp, of course, starting up the 2011 season. Players back on the practice field. We got Coach Harvey Hyde, Dan Weber coming up on the show. Talk to them about this USC football team, expectations for 2011. We've got a ton of questions from you this week. If you have questions, we'd love to hear from you. Podcast at uscfootball.com is our email address. You can just drop us an email or you can give us a call. We got a couple of voicemails today. 206-888-6755 is the number. That's 206-888-6755. Give us a call. We'll play your question on the air. Coach Harvey Hyde is joining us in the first segment. Coach, how are you doing today? Everything good?
I'm doing absolutely beautiful. I tell you, we had a great week last week, last Tuesday over at Media Day. So we had a chance to visit with the coaches and see all our friends in the media and get ready more even for this football season. Agree with the media, disagree with the media, listen to the coaches, get their feelings, and just get started because football season will be opening camp, and that means we're pretty close to the opening game September 3rd in the Coliseum, and that's going to be a good one, I think, against the Golden Gophers.
I agree with you, Coach, and I think this USC fan base is ready for some real football as opposed to talking about sanctions or NCAA, whatever. They want to hear the cracking of the pads, and I think we do as well. We get to start doing that at fall camp. I want to thank our sponsor, Southern California Tickets. SCTickets.com. If you need tickets for any of those upcoming USC home games, seven of them this year, go to SCTickets.com or tickets for anything, concerts, some kind of sporting event besides college football, even though that's what's on our minds right now, the theater. You can call them too, 1-800-888-7287 is their number, or go to SCTickets.com. And Coach, starting things off here, fall camp. I just want to maybe get your thoughts going into this camp. You excited? Are you ready for things to get going here?
I really am. I don't think there's a boring period of sports right now. This is the boringest time of life right now. You open the sports page, and what do? You look at the ads. I don't read the articles. I just want to read the ads because it's not a real exciting time of year. Of course you want to read about the NFL. Are they coming to L.A. or they aren't coming to L.A.? But, you know, there isn't that much. I mean, there wasn't much coverage on the Pac-12 tournament. I mean, not tournament, Pac-10 or Pac-12 media day. I mean, I look to read some articles and get the opinions of people and so on, but I don't know. I guess it's a vacation period for the writers, too, at the papers. And I think it's a setup. I really do. I tell you, you can't get any boringer than what it is until football starts, and then you look forward to your daily article and read Gary Klein and read all the different people and you agree or disagree and you get out to practice and watch the team and see who's playing well and who's playing what position and you start to build up for the football season. But right now, you know, everybody just take a vacation and cool it. If I don't get my morning newspaper, I don't complain. So, but you know what I mean? It's really now when you start to get ready for practice and get ready for football. It's a great time of the year. It's really the most exciting time of the year. It's the thing that sets the tone for the universities. When the students come back to on campus, high schools, when they open up, they come back to football. The whole thing, it's a morale for the alumni, the students, the whole people who love football and love competition and love the bands and love the cheerleaders and song girls and tailgating and all that. How can it get any better than that?
It's tough, Coach. It's tough to get better. And you can, you know, you don't need the paper all the time, Coach. You can go read Dan Weber on uscfootball.com every day, too. I know you like doing that.
I do. And I want you to know that's why your website is so important to freaks like me who need to know what is going on. The first thing you call me to get started on the show like we're doing now, I ask you, what's going on? Tell me what's happened. What do you know? Because it's an information center, your website, and people like to know what's going on, but they don't hear it in the newspaper. They don't hear it even on the reports on, I mean, on TV. I mean, I don't know what these guys are thinking or what they're covering, but they just cover the same thing over and over and over and talk about how many times the guy hit foul balls. I mean, I never heard of anything like that. Or, I mean, get into some other topics. You know what I mean?
I do, and that's what we do here on the Peristyle Podcast. And since we have a lot of questions, Coach, let's jump right into them and see what's going on. Gene is from Coto de Casa. He says he loves the podcast as usual. And the question is for you, Coach. If a miracle happened and you were made USC's head coach, what three or four things would you stress or change with the offense and defense, perhaps a spread offense or shotgun? Love to see. He said, I would love to see you coach this team.
Well, it probably would have to be a miracle. So, and the first thing I'd probably do is to, first of all, not change much. The tradition is there. And the first thing I'd recognize was that I think that the greatest group of players in the Pac-12 are all located at USC. There was a lottery, and you hear me say it every week, that if I had a roster to pick from, if I became a head coach in the Pac-12, where would I go to for my roster to be the USC roster? I think the greatest players and greatest traditions, you can talk about great traditions currently now at Oregon and other places and Stanford. Nothing against any of you alumnus from any of those schools, but USC has what you call, it's the melting pot of college football. It's where the tradition is. It's where it's all at. It's where you can recruit to. It's the Trojan family. And I didn't go to USC, but I can see it. I can see it, and I think you can build around that. And I think it's a great, great place to go to school and get both your academics and your athletic experiences. So I think that probably what I would do is evaluate every player on the team and try to place these players into a position where they could best excel in their abilities. I would first of all make sure I had my best 22 players on the field at all the time. I would not have great backups don't help you. Great players do. And I would want to make sure that all my players were on the field most of the game. And yes, I'd try to rotate some because some are very equal because you have great depth at USC. And I think that I would bring a style of offense that suited the players that were already there. I would then recruit to that as far as after determining what my style of play would be on offense and defense, but I certainly would take advantage of the great players that are currently at USC. And then I would make sure that they all understood what USC football meant, what it's all about, that it's not me, it's team, and that no one is bigger than the USC tradition and the alumni and the people that are there. I certainly would allow, if I could have that happen as far as practice, I don't know what their philosophy is going to be, but I would bring back the enthusiasm at practice. There's nothing like having 1,000 fans at a practice or 500 people at a practice, because the kids get enthused and work hard for the fans that visit practice. Right now, I don't think that the same enthusiasm, I don't see how it could be at practice, because you have 10 people at practice. Before, there used to be 500 people at practice and so on, and the players would look to the sideline not knowing who all the people were, but it really did bring juices to them as far as getting ready to play. And I've talked to players about this, and they agree with me. You always have a greater effort when you know people are there evaluating and watching you and so on. So I would try to talk to Pat Hayden and say, hey, let's open the doors. It's time to get back to USC, time to have the family back and families and ex-players back on the field, on the practice field, and let's be part of what USC is all about. That's one thing I would work for. I would also continue with the recruiting, which is very difficult at this time, but yet you can be very successful at this time. There's 44, I think, freshmen on this team, 21 seniors, 18 juniors, and so on. So you've got a great group of freshmen to get you through this period, and it's the last year of the sanctions or whatever you want to call this stuff. I'd get through it, and this would be my bowl year. I would have 12 bowl games this year, and we'd play them all with that type of attitude. And as I said last week, and I say every week, each week we'd have a special salute to that team as far as the Beaver Bowl or the Duck Bowl or the Bruin Bowl or whatever bowl it'd be. It'd be a special day for us. and I'd have a chart in my locker room that would list our schedule. And after the game, when we got back to the locker room, we'd all gather in there and we'd write the score and put a W next to it. And I think that's the type of things that kids like. Remember, they're big bodies, they run fast and so on, but they're kids. So you have to get kids to want to win for you and win for the school. And you've got to treat them like adults, but yet you have to treat them with respect. And once you know, they know you respect them and you love them and so on, they'll play hard for you. You can't spank a kid when he doesn't think you love him. Once he knows you love him and you care about him 100%, he'll do anything for you. And I think that's what I would do at USC. I'm not saying none of those things are there. They're probably all there. They're probably doing all of those things. But I think it's so important to treat the players with respect and have them know that, yes, this is what it's all about. You play for pride. Don't worry about what the other people think. Worry about what we think and our family. And I think in some cases, negative things brings a team closer together. And I think you really do pull yourself together with the staff and coaches and family and so on. And you really take great pride in beating people when people don't think you can beat them. I really do. And I think it makes it a pretty situation for people who wanted it to be ugly. And I think that's what the situation is, and that's what I do. And have myself surrounded with great coaches, people that wouldn't be afraid to give assignment responsibilities to, let them do it. Don't tell them how to do their job. Monitor both sides of the football, both offensive, defensively, and as far as the kicking game. And I'd be a coach for everyone and love every minute of it.
All right. Great stuff, Coach. And thanks, Gene, for that one. Our old friend Terry and Day had a question for you again, Coach. He said it was interesting on Tuesday to listen to all the coaches put a positive spin on their team's capabilities as they enter fall camp and the season. As Trojan fans in the last decade, we're used to hearing from a coach who knows the teams are in the top of the conference, so the optimism is understanding for these other coaches because now USC is not in the dominant position they once were in. His question was, when you were coaching, how did you approach your team in the years that you knew you were probably a second-tier team? The kids aren't stupid. So, for example, how would you approach a team like Washington State or any other team on the bottom half of the league?
Well, I think you have to be honest. You know, kids are smart. Kids know what their capabilities are and so on, so you have to be realistic with them on what your goals are. You can't set goals that's impossible to reach. Otherwise, you're not getting any better. I remember one year, my second or third year at UNLV, when we had Randall Cunningham. He was a senior, I think he was at that time, Nicky Woods in that group, he was a freshman. I remember we went to the media day, and the coaches, you had a media poll, and I'm laughing. You have a media poll, and you have a coaches poll. And normally, the coaches never voted for themselves, you know. So I remember that at the end of the voting, I'm laughing, but the coaches are still looking at me when I voted for ourselves to win the conference. And the vote was, I don't know how many teams we had in the league, 8 or 9 teams or 7 teams, and the vote was unanimous. It was unanimous that UNLV would win the conference. And they all looked at me and they said, Coach, you must think you're pretty good. I said, hey, I hate to say we're pretty good, but for me to go back and face my team, and there's one guy that didn't vote for UNLV, they would look at me and say, Coach, who was that? And I could not say it was me. So we went back and I told them, hey, guys, we're the favorite to win this conference. That means we got to go out and do it, and I voted for us. And it worked. We went 11-2 that year, won our bowl game, lost to SMU when they had one of the greatest teams around. They beat Notre Dame in their bowl game, the Cotton Bowl. And we lost once at Hawaii on a controversial call there. But we won 11-2. We won our conference, and that happened. Other years, maybe we were picked sixth or fourth or whatever. I was realistic with them. I said, they don't think we're very good. But I'm going to tell you, we're going to be better than what people think. Remember, if they think we should finish fourth and we finish second, we've done a damn good job. And that's what we do. We turn a negative to a positive, like Paul Wolf at Washington State. I think he's going to be better this year than what people think. So, you know, he'll take that and build on that. Everyone picked us for last. So So, guys, every game we win is a game we weren't supposed to win. So let's get out there and let's get it done. They played good at the end of the year. They really did. And I think they'll be a better team this year. So, you know, you can't really be negative. Every coach is going to get out there and say you're better. How can you get up there and say, well, we're not going to be very good this year? You can get out there up there and say, you know, we lost a lot of great players last year, so we're going to have to rebuild, but we're going to play hard. And we're going to count them up at the end of the year and see how many we can win. You know, you know, you're not going to get up there and tell people you're not going to be very good. You've got to get up there and tell the kids know what you're saying, and you tell your kids, hey, kids, we've lost a lot of players. We've got a lot of younger players playing this year, but they're going to get valuable experience, and these kids are going to line up and hit you right in the mouth. And you teach your kids that don't be intimidated, because we've got a great program, and we're going to play them one quarter at a time. So, you know, that's the way you got to go with it.
Makes sense, Coach. All right. Thanks, Terrian, for that one. Mike wanted to know, a lot of specific people asking for, a lot of questions today, Coach, asking for you specifically, so it's good stuff. He wants to know what your opinion is on using a defensive lineman for running the ball in short yardage and goal line situations if the regulars can't get it in there. What do you think about doing something like that, especially in light of Mark Tyler's unknown status right now?
Well, you know, you can do that. Kids have a lot of fun with that. They really do. Kids have a lot of fun when you take one of your more talented big linemen that can run and put them in goal line situations. And it's more or less a challenge to the kids, too, that you can get it in. You know, you call it a certain special player formation when you put your big tackle in and he's a running back and so on. I've done that before. But I've found that it's best not to waste time on that. What I have done is rather have one of my strongest running backs get behind one of those guys and put two of them in or three of them in, or have your strongest players in there and just get in there and blow them out. The timing of the running back, the timing of the handoff, and all of that is very important. But, you know, you can put a guy at fullback like Stanford did last year. They took their middle linebacker and he plays fullback. Tough big kid, fast kid, blows in there, not afraid to hit a linebacker or hit somebody or knock a defensive end out or cut a defensive end down, and have your running back run behind him and then have nice play action passes behind that. So, I think it's great to get in two tight ends at times and three backs in the backfield, and you challenge your kids. You say, hey, you know what? This is a special play or a special series that we have in here, because if we don't make it, we're going to lose, but if we make it, we're going to win. And you just let them know that, hey, here we're in this situation. I call it breaker. I would yell, breaker, 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 which meant we're going to break their back or they're going to break our back. And we'd line up and we'd practice it. In fact, when we practice it, I would allow the defense to have 12 players. I'd tell them over there, they got 12 players. We let the defensive team have 12 players. We'd have 11 players, and we'd challenge ourselves to get in against 12 players. And I think you have to do these things to build confidence up, so that your kids know that when you're in this situation, they will not be denied. They will not be denied. And I think that's part of putting pride in the unit.
All right, cool stuff. I don't know if we'll see that from USC this year, but who knows? Maybe it's something they try. Here's a voicemail question, kind of interesting take on looking at Oregon.
Hello, Ryan. This is Paul from Bakersfield. Hey, first of all, congratulations on your recent nuptials. Last week on the podcast, I don't remember whether it was Coach who was talking about it or somebody brought it up about the new officiating and had brought up the way Oregon handles their snap count or handles the football. And I noticed a couple times last year that it seemed like they had two footballs in play. When the receiver couldn't find the line judge to give him the ball, he would just toss it away. And then we had a line judge or a side judge trying to track down a football while they had a ball boy running the ball onto the field. So they had two footballs in play. And I was just wondering if anybody's ever wanted to discuss that, or maybe the coach could answer that question. But thanks anyway, and continue the good work. We appreciate it up here in Bakersfield. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Paul, thank you for calling. I'll tell you, I've got some great memories of playing out there, playing when I was a head football coach at Pasadena City College. We used to play Jerry Collis up there at Bakersfield. You had great teams at Bakersfield College, and I think you still do, but we used to play up there, and there was 21,000 people there at Bakersfield Stadium. I'll tell you what a beautiful sight that was. That was great junior college football at that time. But let me just get into this, and I'll tell you exactly. I agree with you, Paul, 100%. Even before they played Oregon last year, I watched the officials work games to see exactly the pace of what an official works a game. Now, what I mean by that, I think it's a distinct advantage for Oregon when I watch the umpire spot the ball immediately after a play because Oregon's lined up and they're on the ball. That doesn't mean you should speed up your placing of the football. You should follow your mechanics of what you followed and worked every other game. But it's hard for an official not to speed up his mechanics when you're playing a game, a team like Oregon or Arizona State that just lines up and wants to snap the football, and they're sort of waiting on you. And I really think you have a good point here. I haven't seen the ball boy running the ball in or anything on the field. I don't know if they allow that. I think the side official headline from the field judge always takes the ball in or and gives it to the umpire and they put it down. But it is a unique question because I agree with you 100%. I watched the games very closely, and the same crews who worked the week before pick up their pace as far as working their pace, as far as setting the ball down, as far as spotting it ready to play for Oregon games. And if I was a head coach playing the University of Oregon, I would take video clips of their games the week before, send it to Tony Carreni, who is now the coordinator of officials, and I'd say, now this is the pace this crew works. Against Oregon, they should work the same pace. They should not speed it up just because Oregon wants them to speed it up. If they're going to work that way, the way they work against Oregon all the games, that's fine. But be consistent. Just don't speed it up where Oregon gets an advantage. So I've talked on this topic before, and I really believe that it is an advantage when the crews do speed it up. You'll see them hustling around faster. You'll see them spotting the ball, throwing the ball around faster, trying to put the ball down and so on, which is really an advantage for a team that does that type of or plays that type of game. So I would make a big thing to do with the officials before we played a team that did that, saying, hey, place the ball, do the same mechanics you used last week, this week. Don't change them. Because we've got a clock on you guys from the week before, the couple weeks before, on how just you do work. And I think it's something to be discussed.
Okay. Thanks for that one, Paul. I'll have to watch for that, too. I thought that was kind of an interesting thing. Let's see. John is frustrated a little bit here. John said he watched the Notre Dame game, USC Notre Dame, on ESPNU last week. And it's frustrating to me how much the offense really got worse as the season went on. Lane Kiffin didn't do a very good job, in my opinion. In the red zone, they were terrible. Tunnel screen on the five-yard line, the exact same running play from 1-3 straight snaps, all for no gain. I think this guy's a great recruiter, and he's organized, but as far as play caller goes, I'm not sure he's the answer. He wants to run a pro offense, but how many teams in the league really use the inside zone and outside zone plays and are on tops in the league? Not many. The Broncos were the exception. The good running teams use those schemes, but they use the power O, open slide, ISO, lead draws much more. As far as the passing game goes, they don't stretch backers like they used to. Very few intermediate routes. Is there any chance of eventually having another play caller? So very frustrated, John, there. What are your thoughts on the offense there, Coach?
Well, John obviously knows football. I think he knows football, and he does know exactly what play calling is about and what line blocking schemes are and so on. And you can't allow penetration. And when you do these zone blocking schemes, it's very difficult to stop penetrations. And in short yardage situations, if one guy breaks through the seam or drives you backwards or whatever, the play's shot. The back really didn't have a shot. I think you've got to be able to blow people out on the line of scrimmage. I think the game is won on the line of scrimmage, offensively as well as defensively. I think you have to have certain plays that you do, double team down and kick out and lead guards through or lead fullbacks through and learn to to play what you call tough football. You can't be soft on the offensive line. You've got to be tough on the offensive line. You've got to have your elbows bleeding. You've got to be able to play tough football because you're going against some of the top athletes that are on a football team in the defensive fronts today. Guys that are big, strong, and fast and want to come after you. So you've got to be as big and tough and strong and nasty and angry as they are because the line of scrimmage is where the point of attack is. And I think that nothing frustrates me more when you're on the second two, or say you're on the 2 yard line or 3 yard line, and you come out with no remaining backs, or you come out and throw up some type of bubble screen or something that is tipped on the line of scrimmage or whatever, and you lose yards. And that, you know, the name of the game, remember, when you get down there towards the end zone, the field shortens. The field becomes shorter, which means there's less territory to defend. So that means it comes to a point now where you got to run at people, and you've got to be able to kick some butt. And if you don't kick some butt and they don't have respect for you being able to run the football down, they'll play the pass because they know you can't run it in. So, but if they know you can run it in, then the play-action pass is really a valuable piece of your goal-line offense because they know that, uh-oh, these guys can run it in. These guys can get nasty. And then the little simple pass, play-action pass, back in the flat, drags, different things, quick outs, and so on are there. So, yeah, I agree with 100%. You've got to be angry. You've got to be nasty. You've got to be able to have that type of offensive line and that type of offense to get in when you're down there.
Okay, let's see. One last thing, Coach. We weren't going to have Gerard Martinez on this week, and we did have a lot of recruiting questions, but we had so many team questions as well in the fall camp starting this week. We're going to kind of focus this podcast on the team. But this one came up before, and I thought maybe we could address it real quick for Stephen, or it's Stefan, I think it's, but he said, with the sanctions that USC are facing, particularly the 75 scholarship limit, he was wondering if it is possible for players to opt out of their scholarship and pay their way to USC in full. It's an expensive proposition, but he gave some examples, like, say, you know, Matt Barkley's family was wealthy and they wanted to give back the scholarship. Were they available to do that? I think we talked about this before, Coach, and if I remember your answer correctly, it's going to be a funny one.
Well, no, I'm not going to be funny.
Okay.
I'm going to say it would be tremendous if people like that were that loyal to a program to say, you know what, I'm willing to help the program. This is my son's maybe final year, and we're willing to pay. He'll probably be there if he's planning on coming out one semester, right? So he'd be playing one semester, then he'd be going to all of the combines and all the different things if he had a great year. If you're able to do that, it would be a tremendous thing. And I think it would, again, angry, maybe the NCAA or whatever, but that's too bad. But it's not realistic. You don't see that happening very often, yet I'd love to see that happen. To say there are parents that can't afford to do that, that would be a tremendous thing to do. But I don't think that will happen. But it would, say, five parents, let's say out of 75 or 85 parents were willing to do that, that would, what an effect that would make on the football team. It would be an absolute tremendous thing to be able to do that, especially if there are five seniors and this was their final year and you could pick who those seniors are or juniors are that are planning on coming out. If they had that type of year, it'd be a tremendous thing to do, which you would be able to replace those scholarships then if they didn't count because those people didn't take them. So realistic, no. Would it be great? Yes. I don't think that – good question, though. Good question because it might ring a bell in somebody's ear that's listening.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, USC is an expensive school to go to. If you were going to a smaller public school that tuition wasn't that expensive, maybe that would be a little easier to do. But it is very high at USC. You're talking, I mean, even if
30 grand for a semester.
Yeah, but even if a family is loaded, is there pride there, or is there something that would, an ego that would make you not want to, hey, I want to be on scholarship, even though, people that could afford tuition. You're going to be paying a lot of money.
Not me. If I had that kind of money, a lot of kind of money, I'd want to be a part of the program, man. I'd say if this helps our program for one semester, we're going to pay this semester. My son's been on scholarship 2 years now. We appreciate everything. If this will put another kid on scholarship and help the program, if I had that kind of money, I would do it. Too bad I didn't have a lot of money. You probably couldn't do it if you did 10 kids. Wouldn't that be something if some rich guy had a kid and he said, you know what, we'll pay for 10 kids. That would really be, then the NCAA would really be ringing their cowbell.
Cool. All right, Coach. Well, we appreciate you coming on, sharing some time over in Catalina Island. Enjoy your time over there, and hope it's a fun summer day for you, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks a lot, Ryan. We want to thank everybody out there for checking in with us, and you guys have a great summer, and don't worry about if your sports page isn't in your paper.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Coach, and we'll be back in 30 seconds talking with USCFootball.com beat writer Dan Weber. Lots to get to, lots of topics, and lots more of your questions.
Meet us on the other side of the break for more of the Peristyle Podcast. Tickets, tickets, tickets. SC Tickets is your concert, sports, and theater ticket source. We have the tickets you need to any event worldwide. Football tickets are now available. Call SC Tickets now at 1-800-888-7287. 1-800-888-7287. That's 1-800-888-7287. Or visit us on the web at sctickets.com. SC Tickets, concert, sports, and theater. We now return to the Peristyle Podcast and your host, Ryan Abraham.
Welcome back to the Peristyle Podcast. We have the man who covers the USC Trojans for USCFootball.com on the line, Dan Weber. Dan, how's it going?
Very good, Ryan, and it's a good week. We finally get to go. Thursday night, we're ready to go. That couldn't come soon enough.
I agree with you 100%. Can't wait to get going Thursday night. They'll have some night practices, which is kind of interesting. I thought there'd be a lot of morning ones. Practice time's kind of all over the place, but we'll be back there out in Howard Jones Field, a little bit in the Coliseum as well, covering the team, and check out USCFootball.com for all the latest. We'll have some position previews going on all this week on USCFootball.com. We'll launch our Fall Camp Central page, like a one-stop shopping for everything going on for USC Fall Camp. So should be some good stuff. I know you're excited for it.
Yeah, I think it was interesting, Lane. It was kind of kidding, Lane, at media day about how many different starting times they have for practice. And, you know, there's six different game starting times. And I said, you've got more than that for your practices. And it was an interesting comment. He said the essential reason that they're changing their starting times is because with the summer classes and different things like that, they wanted to accommodate every single player's academic schedule, so that basically they tracked down everyone, you know, every guy, and you know, on every day what they can, you know, what time can you make it and all that, and they basically adjusted practice schedules from early morning to, you know, evening, essentially because of academics. So you got to give them credit for that. I don't think you see that much, and I think they're still in that, you know, change over time when they're rearranging academic schedules to clear away the morning, you know, in the fall for practice time. So they had to do a little, you know, scrambling, I think, this summer. But that's the reason that the practices are going to, you know, move all around. And it's probably a good thing when you think about it, because their game times are sure going to be all over the board and all, you know, three different days of the week, you know, Thursday night game, Friday night game, Saturday games that start as early as 12:30, and, you know, essentially a noon game, and then games that start as late as 8. So, you know, they don't need they need an alarm clock or a secretary or something, but you don't want to get into any kind of a, you know, like rhythm, like this is when we, you know, every day this is when we're going to practice, or every day this is when we're going to play a game. There is no more of that.
No, I was putting it all into my calendar just because there's practice times all over the place, so making sure I know when they're practicing and when to be down there. And just got an email this morning three more of those practice
times. Exchange three more.
Yeah.
Three more practice times, James. So I think we got some new times in there, ones that hadn't been used yet. So, you just better be, pay attention every day and every play. And it's probably, for everybody involved, maybe it's a good thing. But they're not going to be any routine days, that's for sure.
And there's not much two-a-day practices going on. There's a couple of, two or three of them in there.
Two times or two-a-days. And they get to the Coliseum earlier this year, which I think is probably a good thing. Pay a little more attention to the Coliseum. They were there, every Saturday pretty much last spring. And I kind of like that. I think the Coliseum maybe was the whole idea of, it's our Coliseum and nobody else comes in here and takes it away from us. Kind of got lost a little bit in the shuffle last year. I thought Lane also had a good answer to that at Media Day when he said, I said, what do you do to, Pete was so successful when you were here. You guys won all those, games in a row at the Coliseum, 3 years, nobody beat you. And so what do you, how do you think, how does that work? And Lane said, he said, every one of those games we lost, we were winning in the second half. He said, if we'd have just finished them out, it's not so much, the fact that it was the Coliseum. He said, we just didn't finish games. We didn't finish half times. We didn't finish quarters. We didn't finish. And he said, I think that, the ability to finish changes everything. And he's right. They basically led in the second half and in every game they lost at the Coliseum, and probably shouldn't have at least two of those anyway. So we'll see. But there does seem to be more of an emphasis on the Coliseum this year.
We got from Lewis a couple of defensive line questions. Maybe we can jump into that. He was talking about Armon Armstead moving from defensive end to defensive tackle and practicing with the first team. Obviously, we're still waiting on his status right now, but, we'll see if he's going to be cleared. There was also reports coming out about George Uko playing the same position and heard that he would look like he's one of the best on the team during spring football. He said if Armstead is cleared to play, do you think the coaches would move Uko to the nose tackle and so he could play next to Armstead?
I think that's a possibility. Yeah, I think essentially you have to look at that as a four-man rotation, and they're doing a lot of where two of them are playing the three technique or whatever. So I think there's gonna be a lot of mix and matching with the four. You throw Christian Tupou in there and Dejon Harris, and you've got two real veterans with, real talent. So I don't know that you're going to look at that defensive front, if you get all four of them rotating. I don't think you're going to look at it as, one guy, one position or whatever. I think you're going to look at it all four of them playing two positions and being able to do, pretty much, both techniques that you need. So, I think that's the ideal situation. If you can get four to play the two spots and just go all out and play the way, Ed Orgeron wants you to play and just be able to, do the things that, very often last year, they were down to this two-tackle rotation for the Oregon, the Oregon game, and they just ran out of gas. But you put four of those guys, all who've played except for Uko, who's just coming in with, tremendous physical skills, in that rotation, you've got a heck of a rotation, but I wouldn't get too locked into that you need these two guys playing next to one another. I think the rotation, will use all four for the two spots if all four are able to go.
I think that's kind of part of his follow-up as well. They're going to try to get, rotations in there, like you said, but he was suggesting – Lewis was suggesting, do you think something like this would help against an offense like Oregon if you line up Kennard at left defensive end, who's moved down, and Perry at right defensive end with Armstead and Uko in the middle, and don't flip the strong side and weak side with tight end shifts like they did last year?
I mean, I think that's to be determined. I don't know that they've decided if they're going to, you know, make it a little more simple where, you know, and play the way, for example, they played against Cal last year, when basically they went, you know, strong side to the wide side, and they predetermined, and they lined up, you know, left and right, and just went that way. It was simpler, and it certainly was effective. I think that's one of the key decisions they're going to have to make. You know, last year, I think because of, you know, the newness and because, you know, the coaches knew to the players knew to the system to some extent, I thought, you know, they had some difficulty adjusting to formations after the, you know, offense would break the huddle. And they had difficulty, I think, at times communicating, you know, what the adjustments were going to be. And they were late getting into the defense, I thought. And I thought that was one of the things that really, you know, helped them against Cal, is they predetermined it basically by the wide side and, you know, made that the strong side. That's kind of would be my preference. But with this team, I think they're going to be able to do more, and they're going to be able to adjust quicker, and they're going to be able to, you know, I just don't want them to get too tricky. I mean, I think this is a team with a lot of talent. I mean, I don't know how many anybody in the country got better defensive ends than Devon Kennard and Nick Perry physically. I you know, show me. you know, I don't know that you need to get too tricky with guys like that. I just think basically you just want to line up and play hard, play fast, and play aggressive. And probably you want them playing first, thinking second. You know, I don't think you want them, you know, overthinking too much and trying to say, well, what was that call? What are we, you know, what combination defense is this or whatever? I'd like to see them try to take people out fairly early in the game, put them in, you know, and the difference this year, you hope, is that when a team is third and 12, it's USC's advantage, not the third and 12 team, you know. last year, it was basically you'd rather it be third and two than third and 12. And that's no exaggeration. I mean, that's absolutely the truth. I think, you know, there were a sense that USC had a better chance of stopping somebody if it was third and two than third and 12. And that it was stunning. I mean, their inability to play third and long. And you don't think that's going to be the case this year. You just think, okay, they're not going to be able to have enough time to do a lot of third and 12. And that was a big difference with Pete's teams, that when they were really good, is when you were third and 12, you had to take a chance. And very often, they're going to turn you over, get a short field, you know, make it easy on the offense, that kind of thing. And that stopped happening, you know, the last 3 or 4 years. And it really made things tougher. And one would like to think that with the kind of athletes that they're going to have up front, they're going to be able to put pressure on people, put them in situations where they have to take a chance, and they're going to be able to take advantage of it. I mean, that to me is the key for the whole season, is, you know, make it easier on your offense, really, really take teams out of games with your defense. And that almost didn't happen at all last year, where they were just able to flat out take a team out with their defense. And I think for this team to be a good team, when they play people like Utah and Arizona State in that first, you know, in the month of September in the Pac-12, they need their defense to take the other team's offense out of the game and turn it into a liability and turn it into USC ball and short fields and things like that. And that just has to happen with this team this year. And it looks like they've got the athletes to have a chance to do that. But, you know, we'll see. With Armand, we haven't heard anything. They have not heard, we understand, may have had his last physical test and all that. Don't think they've heard back yet. They've been guaranteed they will know something before Thursday. So have to be on alert for that one. But we know he was optimistic, and his dad was optimistic the last time we talked to him recently. So I guess we'll be optimistic until we hear differently.
Yeah, that's good. Ed had that question. When are we going to hear on Martin Armstead? And Ed, just let you know, like Dan said, we'll probably hear something, you know, in the very beginning of fall camp is what we're expecting to hear. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, Armand said he was guaranteed that they would have an answer. He also said, though, I guess, and the second thing he did say was the answer might be they don't have an answer. They may still not know, think they know enough. And he's now under the care of a top cardiologist at USC Medical Center. Now he's meeting with the top blood, I'm not sure exactly what the specialty is called, but it's a person who diagnoses blood diseases and disorders and that kind of thing. So it's in that area now as to they've been basically medicating him and running tests and letting him work out, work hard, do all the weightlifting, do all the conditioning and that kind of thing. And seeing how he reacts to whatever regimen they have him on, which we don't know any of that. We have no details about any of the treatment or any of the the things they're looking at. But we do know that he's definitely being evaluated all through the summer. He certainly looks good. He certainly feels good. He's certainly upbeat about it. I wish we knew more, but I thought I heard today that they didn't hear anything yet. As of this morning, they hadn't heard anything.
Okay, well, we'll keep you guys updated on all that. Once soon as we find anything out, we'll post up stuff on USCfootball.com. Jeff had a question on Will Andrew, linebacker Will Andrew. He looked really impressive in the spring. Do you think that USC, what are the chances USC gets a guy like that into the mix?
Well, all he does is make plays. He goes out there in the summer and, he'll jump on, a route and get an interception. He's not a flashy guy, but, things don't drop off that much when he's out there. I mean, one would think that, you're looking at the new freshmen and, want to give them a chance or whatever. But he's just a solid guy who you trust and you feel like he belongs there. Now you've got Dallas Kelly also at that spot. And, they give you kind of two of a similar kinds of guys at that spot. He's always going to be in the mix because he he can make plays. He's so unflashy. He just doesn't do anything that draws attention to himself except, make a play. I think he's in the mix for sure. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I think we're going to see, we've talked about this before a little bit. We're going to see bigger rotations. You're going to see more guys play. There was too many guys gassed at the end of games. And, Ed Orgeron talked about playing eight guys on the line. I think we might see more guys mixed in from linebacker. It seems like the coaches are going to trust the players a little bit. Maybe they didn't trust everyone.
Yeah, I think that's a key word. I think that the word trust. I think it's got to be the combination between players trusting the coaches and what they're doing and really knowing what they're doing, and the coaches trusting the players and knowing the players better and knowing that, I think that's a, especially on defense, I think that trust factor really matters. And I think there's much more of that this year. I mean, I think part of it last year was it was such a transition that nobody knew exactly what to expect with the coaches, with the players, and vice versa. And it just kind of, then there was a tendency to only play certain guys just because you weren't sure what everybody could do, what they knew. And then you ran out of gas. It was and then you had the situation where they weren't tackling as well in practice. So, they didn't get a chance to develop their depth, and they didn't get a chance to find other people to trust. And I think that's happened a lot over the winter in the way they've watched film together, the way they've worked on their communication, skills, and the way that, the coaches coached them up in spring ball. I think if you run into Monty now, he's an entirely different person from what we saw last year. I think he's so much more upbeat. I think he just really feels like he understands what he's got and to work with and where they are. And, you know, after you've been in the NFL for as many years as he'd had, even though they had the 1 year at Tennessee, I think, and, you know, it was still all new players. I think it was a real learning experience, and I just think he feels so much more. He's a guy that, you know, gets close to the people he's coaching and really needs to know them and like them and, you know, feel like he just understands them. And I think you see that now in a way you didn't see it at all last year. And it's just it seemed like a much better situation.
All right. We have a voicemail question from guys that has to do with the officiating stuff that we learned about last week at the seminars. Here you go.
Hi, guys. This is Guy, a singular guy. And I'd like to ask a question of either Coach Hyde or Dan, and that would be about this new rule about taunting. Lack of taunting or not anti-taunting rule. I believe it's a very dangerous rule, and it'll make a mess of games. I think that it's a sinister sort of thing, and I think it puts too much power into the discretion of any single zebra out there that wants to change the outcome of a game. Anybody could claim taunting. You don't have to prove it, right? And so, and there's no replay. So, some zebra says doesn't like USC taunting. Touchdown is finished. I would like to hear a response to that, and fight on. And thank you very much in advance.
Okay, Guy. I think it would be a really legitimate question if this were the rule last year, or if. Last year's entire crew of officials had been brought back to the Pac-12. You might be rightly so nervous about putting that kind of power into the hands of people who, you know, shown that they didn't care what the imbalance in calls were, didn't care how obvious it was that they were calling it, you know, against USC, for example, didn't mind a bit. I don't think this year's crews are going to do that. I think they actually are just going to, you know, much more like an NFL game where you don't get a sense that they're trying. You know, they might make a mistake, but it's not like the sense that they're invested in one team or the other team. I do think with college football, the problem will be, I was watching some, previous year's games, and you watch a touchdown and you see, whatever happens, and you think, gosh, now would that be, what would they call that this year? And you're thinking, I don't know, that's close. What is that? Is that spontaneous, not trying to show them, or is that like, oh, and you say, you wish they didn't have to make that call. The second thing is, they have to be very careful that they don't call that one way on the road and another way at home, because, you know, if you score a touchdown at Autzen Stadium, game-deciding touchdown or whatever, and there is one of those semi-spontaneous, really, you know, pile-on end zone kind of a deals, you know, as loud and as close as that crowd is to the field, you know, is that one of those ones where you have a much better chance of getting it called on the road against you than at home? Because the road crowd is going to be all over those officials to make that call. I think it puts the officials under a lot of pressure in certain situations. So that's one you don't like to see it where there's a call that if the game's played at home, it goes one way, and if it's played on the road, it goes another way. And that one worries me a little bit, how the officials handle the pressure of a crowd that will be right on top of them demanding that this celebration went over the line or there was taunting I know he was yelling at our player, not at his own guy standing next to our player. I mean, of course, who knows who you were yelling at? It's a worry. I think the home road and impact of the crowd on the officials there is where you have to just hope that you really do have big-time professional guys who all that, you know, as they said last week at the officiating seminar, we do not want to be the penalty police. And I take them at their word. I trust them. I like their demeanor. I like their attitude. I like the people they've got running it. We're going to trust them, but it does put them under a little more pressure, and they know it. I mean, they heard all the people reacting last week to, and all the questions that came about that rule. That was the rule that everybody wanted to ask them about, and it's the one that people were worried about, and it's the one, I think, where the home crowd will think it can influence the officials a little bit if there's any kind of a prolonged celebration. So I'll give you a little bit on that one and say I'm going to trust the officials until we see differently, but they're going to have to deal with it.
I was mentioning it to Coach Hyde off the air before we talked, and he was curious about the rule, and I was explaining to him one of the questions that was asked at the officiating seminar is, you know, if the guy jumps, dives in the end zone from the 2, it's a spot foul from the 2, 15 yards from there. But if it's, say, the quarterback from the 35-yard line throwing a pass, he taunts a defensive lineman, it's a spot foul from the 35, so the offense would get the ball at the 50. And Coach Hyde actually brought up, what if it's a 90-yard pass and you're doing it from the 10-yard line, and it's like a,
wow.
You get all the way back, you take 90 yards off the, points off the board, and you get like a halfway, half the distance to the goal penalty, you start off from the 5-yard line. So, I mean, something like that could be an absolutely enormous penalty.
Well, and the other part of that is what happens so often is they see the second half of the play in the penalty. So let's say you have a situation where the original taunt comes from the defensive guy, and the quarterback maybe stupidly reacts. And by the time the referee is looking back at the play, he sees the quarterback taunt the defensive end, having missed maybe the defensive end yelling at the quarterback. Then he throws the flag. Holy criminy. I mean, just think of the way that could change a game. I mean, and obviously we know, the Torrin Harris, Tyron Smith blocked the extra point against Arizona State. Torrin Harris, runs it down to the 5 and then decides to, leap into the end zone. And those 2 points would have been gone forever. There would have been no replay because that would have been the end of the play. Take them off the, off the board, and USC ends up winning the game by point. Well, they wouldn't have won the game by a point. And, there may have been an execution on the sideline at that point. I mean, honest guy, if you do something and you get your score taken off the board, I can't even imagine running back to this. That's one of those plays where you either run up the tunnel or you run to the other side of the field, but you probably don't want to run back to your own bench, I'm thinking.
Yes.
If by the time you get there, the points have already been taken off the board. That would be like the longest. Hopefully they keep running that play, because I think everybody in the Pac-12 is going to run that play for every team to show them this is what could happen to you. You have to run to the sideline, and you're not going to get those 2 points after you ran 90-some yards with the football. So I think USC, that penalty, that extra point, blocked extra point, will be shown to every team in the Pac-12. And it's something you just don't even want to think about as a player. Hopefully that will scare them enough to just say, I run up, I cross the end zone, I cross the goal line into the end zone, turn around, hand the football to the referee, and just keep running and get to the sidelines. The thought of, end zone celebration should just be out of the picture at this point. It's not worth taking a chance.
Yeah, no, completely. We'll see if the coaches address that at all. in fall camp, and we'll report on that for you. One last thing. Jeff in Boston is a longtime Trojan fan. He says he loves the podcast and has been listening to every episode since number 20. But he had so I've been listening a long time. We're on episode 180 right now, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
He had a different opinion on this lack of fairness in the NCAA. He said, in his opinion, USC was guilty of loss of institutional control and failure to monitor. USC's athletic department clearly failed to monitor the NCAA. And the administration obviously lost control of the athletic department for allowing them to ignore such an important stakeholder. Secondly, I disagree that the perception of the NCAA is inconsistent in its rulings. In my opinion, they are incredibly consistent. They always give preferential treatment to the insiders like OSU. That said, the solution to USC's dilemma is easy: become an insider. Suing over spilled milk won't solve anything. In fact, it might set the relationship back even further. Just his thoughts. It's frustrating to see politics in sports, but that's how large organizations operate. The faster USC learns this, and I suspect Pat Hayden already has, the better. Love the show. Keep up the great work. Jeff.
Let's hope what Jeff said at the very end there is correct, that there has been a learning curve that has actually involved real learning about, I will say this, the first column I wrote, first week I was here, got killed by people on the P, because I had said years ago covering USC that they needed to end the NCAA, charade after a year. They needed to self-penalize, they needed to self-report, they needed to do everything they could. They needed to get on the NCAA side, and they needed to make it look like that was the case. Whether that was the right thing to do, the fair thing, whatever, it was the best thing for USC to do. A lot of people didn't agree with me then. I think everybody probably agrees with me now. I think the NCAA went to a length of bias in terms of, coming after USC that you couldn't even imagine. And they did things in terms of some of the findings and making up evidence and saying people said things that they didn't say, and they're tying it to Todd McNair in ways in which they haven't even thought about doing to any other coach at any other program. And hopefully they'll pay a severe penalty for that in civilian court, where they actually have to be able to prove what they say. But you're right. Jeff is right. USC should have been on top of the NCAA much more than they were, should have monitored it more. I know it's easy to say that in hindsight, but I think it was obvious the NCAA was under a great deal of pressure to nail USC, and since USC hadn't really defended itself in any public way, they allowed the media to jump on that bandwagon and for 3 and 4 years just scream and shout, how ineffective the NCAA was, because they didn't do anything with USC. Now they know that the NCAA isn't effective even when it does something, because they've got too many insiders to deal with, too many, they can't penalize UConn, for example, in basketball during the season, because UConn's too important to them for all the money the NCAA makes in the men's basketball tournament. I mean, there are completely different standards for football and basketball. The NCAA doesn't make any money in football, so what do they care who they penalize? But I guarantee you, for example, watching Kentucky in basketball, who make all kinds of money for the NCAA, watching how they deal with USC in football, which they don't care, it's obviously a double standard. Or watching how they treat an SEC school. Do you think an SEC school would not be allowed, to play in the first ever SEC championship game? That's just not going to happen. But they don't really care that much about the Pac-12. Pac-12 has to make them care. It has to be on the inside in ways in which, it probably makes you feel a little unseemly that you'd want to be on the inside with, people like Paul D and, Missy Conboy at Notre Dame, who seems to have a great deal of difficulty knowing what's going on in her own athletic department, but wanted to know how did that Reggie Bush 9-year-old Impala get all tricked up and nobody noticed it, and it just, she had no idea what she's talking about. But that those people can sit in judgment of lack of institutional control at USC, and you see what's going on at their programs, and you think, it's not exactly, you know, what you know or what you're doing, but who you know and how much they decide not to take it out on you. I mean, to have no lack of institutional control on Ohio State is just beyond mind-boggling, or UNC. You just think, this is incredible. But Jeff has a really good take on it, that USC, part of USC's institutional control in athletics should have been monitoring the NCAA more closely and making sure that, you know, the NCAA wasn't able to take the kind of shot at USC that USC kind of gave them a chance to take. And let's hope there has been a lot of learning about that. We would have to assume that there has, because probably to this point we haven't heard anything from anybody at USC that makes us believe that there's been a lot of learning in that particular area. But we shall see. Maybe actions will speak louder than words, but we just haven't heard anybody at USC either make the case for USC or make the case against the NCAA in ways in which at least people would say, okay, they really do get it, and they need to make the NCAA understand they get it. I mean, the NCAA isn't nice to the Big Ten or the SEC because they like them. They're nice to them because they better be nice to them, because bad things will happen if they don't treat the SEC with the respect that Mike Fly wants them treated with. They know it. I think they thought we could do whatever we want to USC. They're the outsiders. They're the hated, you know, hot dogs on the West Coast. What do we care? There have to be consequences. I thought the NCAA thought we can do whatever we want in this case and we can get away with it. And, you know, mostly they did. The Todd McNair case should be very interesting to see if the NCAA has to pay a price for what they did in the USC case.
All right, Dan.
There's
great
rant. That's my weekly NCAA rant.
Yeah, I know. We had another one, too, Ed. Sorry we didn't get to that one. We had a bunch of other recruiting questions, too, we couldn't get to today. So sorry about that. We had a ton of questions. We tried to get to every one of them. And we'll, you know, we have more podcasts and stuff coming up, of course. Send your questions in again if we didn't get to them this week. Thank you, Dan, for coming on. Thanks to Coach Harvey Hyde. And it was great talking again, Dan. We'll see you out there Thursday for
we'll
fall
camp. We'll see you out there Thursday. Can't wait.
Yeah, we're going to do our Ustream show from McKay's. So just before fall camp, we'll have our live show. Check uscfootball.com for that. And then we'll be over at McKay's at 4 o'clock. Then we'll go over to campus at 7 for the opening of fall camp. So it should be a fun time.
Big, big, big day. Can't wait. Thursday. Come on. Let's go.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Don't forget, Thursday at 4 p.m., check out our Ustream show. And we'll be back with our regular podcast next Monday. Will be after the first couple days of fall camp. We'll get the report on that. So stay tuned.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast presented by uscfootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your iPod or MP3 player for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.